You're listening to The Zen Courses Show, episode 26.
Welcome to The Zen Courses Show, the show for online course creators who care about building actionable, meaningful, and profitable online courses. If you're a solo entrepreneur, tech geek, or creative, The Zen Courses Show is the place to get expert advice for creating your online course, overcoming overwhelm, and growing a balanced business. To get the full experience, sign up at zencourses.co, where you'll get access to free lessons, resources, and more. Again, that's zencourses.co.
Hey there, it's Janelle. Listen, before we jump into today's interview, I just wanted to take a moment to give you a primer on what you can expect. So this episode is with Tara Gentile. You may know her from TaraGentile.com. Her new brand is Quiet Power Strategy over at QuietPowerStrategy.com. What I really want you to know is that, in my opinion, this is a great interview, but in my opinion, the gold of the interview is about the last 20 minutes. In that last 20 minutes, Tara tells us what I think she's an absolute genius at, which is researching and figuring out exactly, and I mean exactly, who your audience is. Tara has specific strategies that she uses to discover exactly who her audience is, and she develops different, not necessarily profiles, because she doesn't like that term, but she has a clear picture of the different types of people who engage with her and exactly what they need with her, from her, rather, exactly what their challenges are, so that she can take action to create products to give them what they want. So if that sounds like something that you're struggling with or that you want to learn more about, stay tuned. Don't change. I was about to say don't change the channel, but this is a podcast. So listen all the way through. You're going to enjoy this one. What's up, everyone? Thank you for tuning into the Zen Courses Show. I've got a great episode for you today. I am incredibly honored to speak with Tara Gentile. If you don't know Tara, well, I'm just not sure where you have been hiding, because she's been rocking the online world for years. Tara is the brains, heart, and face behind TaraGentile.com, where she helps entrepreneurs tap into their strengths and grow their business. She's here to talk about her courses and thoughts on online learning. Tara, welcome to the Zen Courses Show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I am super excited to chat with you. So I know that was a lot. Is there anything that I left out that you want to add to that intro?
That we're really focusing all our efforts on the Quiet Power Strategy brand right now. And so that's often the best place for people to find me. And it's what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to talk about
that. Awesome.
Okay, so let's just start with some easy stuff. Where are you from, Tara?
I am from central Pennsylvania, the capital city of Harrisburg, and I'm currently in Lititz, which is in Lancaster County, and that is Amish country.
Yeah, I saw some of your Instagram posts of your trip across the country, so yeah. It seemed like a fun time.
Indeed.
Okay, so outstanding. Let's have some fun and help people get to know you a bit. I've got five medium rapid fire questions for you. Are you ready for this?
Absolutely.
Okay. First one is an easy one. Early bird or night owl?
More of an early bird.
Okay. There was some hesitation there.
Well, you know, it goes back and forth. My partner is definitely a night owl, and yeah, he would like for me to stay up later. But most of the time I'm in bed by 10 and I'm awake by 6. So.
I struggle as well. Yeah. So I feel your pain. Okay. And I also know via Instagram that you are a craft beer enthusiast. So what is your favorite beer at the moment?
Ooh, yes. I love, 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 love beer, even if it doesn't always love me. So my absolute favorite beer, hands down, is Breakside's IPA. Breakside is a little brewery in Portland. They're not little, but they certainly don't have widespread distribution. And they won the Great American Beer Fest gold medal for IPAs 2 years ago. So it really is just top-notch, everything I want in an IPA, and I am a hophead.
Interesting. So I have to ask, because I'm in Chicago, have you tried out our Goose Island Brewery here in Chicago?
I have had some Goose Island, yeah. Most of the stuff that they're doing that's really interesting right now is not my favorite stuff. So they're doing like some sours and barrel-aged stuff that's, you know, not done by, I forget who bought them out now, but that it's not the contract brewing. It's the stuff that they're still doing. It's just not my favorite thing, although I really, really appreciate it. However, there's another Chicago brewery that Sean and I are totally into. I'm thinking of the right one. Half Acre. That's in Chicago. Yeah. We are all over Half Acre right now. And I'm going to be in Chicago for Podcast Movement in July. And we are both going to Half Acre. And I'm really excited about it.
I can tell you're brimming with excitement. Yeah. Okay. Very cool. All right. So question three, fill in the blank. If I weren't doing the work I am today, I would be blank.
It is so hard to imagine my life not doing what I'm doing today. I can imagine not writing about business, but I think that I would still be writing about something online, whether it was politics or religion or beer or whatever it is. I can't imagine not being part of the online community and writing and creating for a living. It's what I did before I even had a business, and I can't imagine just not doing it.
Okay. Good answer. Number four, I know you do a lot of traveling and you traveled all over. So what is your favorite city and why?
Oh, I mean, I really hate to be cliche. But I love Portland. I still love Portland. I haven't been in Portland now for like 6 months, and we're going back in April, and I'm just so excited. I love the culture. I love the weather. I love the people. I love the beer. I love the food. And I love its proximity to so many other amazing things, waterfalls, rainforests. I mean, it is just, it's an incredible place.
Yeah, I love Portland too. You don't often hear people say they love the weather, though.
I know, but if you live there, you realize it's really not that bad.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So last question, who has had the biggest influence in who you are today as an entrepreneur?
Oh, definitely. That's an easy one. That's my mother. My mother was a small business owner when I was growing up. She had a seamstress business, and that's how she put food on the table and a roof over our head. We didn't have a ton of money, but what we had was a lot of agency and flexibility and just a really healthy attitude towards money, even though we didn't have a lot of it. And so that has by far been the biggest influence on me as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, and also just sort of also as a mother and a woman as well.
Yeah, that's so something you said there just really struck me, because often you hear stories, you know, when people grow up not having a lot of money, they have, you know, a lot of trauma and challenges talking about money. And I think that is when you said you've had a really healthy relationship with money. How did your mom help you to have that?
Yeah, so all of the like quote unquote trauma that I had money wise definitely came after I had a full-time job.
Gotcha.
It was kind of living the paycheck to paycheck thing, having a paycheck to begin, like having that steady paycheck that really rewired a lot of my money thinking in a very negative way. So a couple things that she did. One, you know, there was always a way to find the money we needed to do the things we wanted to do. So, you know, even though we didn't have a lot of money, I was involved in sports. I was really involved in music, which is not a cheap thing to do.
Yeah, it's not.
But she knew these were the things that were important to me. And if an opportunity arose, we found a way. We had nothing to do with it. She found a way to make that happen. And so that really, I mean, that gave me that really entrepreneurial money mindset, which is you know, there is no finite amount of money. There's only what you're willing to go out and do, whatever value you're willing to create, whatever opportunity you're willing to capitalize on to get what you need or to create what you want. And so that was huge. That was really what that steady paycheck rewired for me, because then there was always a set amount and I was constantly debiting against that set amount instead of creating more. Right. There was no opportunity to create more. The other thing that she did for me was I started earning money at a pretty early age. At the age of 14, I decided I wanted to be a softball umpire. I couldn't play anymore. Or I couldn't play as much as I had been playing, but I could earn money as an umpire. So I went to the official ASA training, and I did that, and I started getting assigned to games, and we got paid $24 a game, which it's not a lot of money in and of itself, but when you're talking about a 14 or 15 year old kid who's working 2 hours to earn 24 bucks, it was really awesome. Yeah. So she made me put 12 of that $24, so half, in the freezer. We did get bank accounts then. I've had a bank account for a very long time, but initially we were putting the cash, because it was all paid in cash. We were putting the cash in the freezer. So half of it went in this envelope, and then the other half I could do whatever I wanted with. And that was the important part. Like, yes, the saving part was important, but it was the flexibility of knowing that you had saved a significant sum of money that allowed me the flexibility and detachment from the other money that I had earned, the money that was in my pocket, so that I had a really good relationship with what was coming in and what was coming out, because I knew I was taking care of myself and I knew I had money that I wanted to spend. And so it was a really nice balance. And that was just an incredible lesson in terms of my money relationship early on.
Yeah, it's amazing. Before we move on, it's just amazing how the lessons that we're taught as a child, even if we go on a detour, it comes back. Mm-hmm. So that's having that foundation from your mother. Okay, so that is actually a great segue into finding out how you became an entrepreneur, because you just said you were an employee for a period of time. So tell us your story. How did you get to this place?
Yeah, so my story starts in college, where I studied religious studies. I don't have an MBA, I don't have a BBA, I don't have any formal business education. I studied religious studies and I loved it. I had wanted to be a religion professor since I was probably about 12, and which I know is a very weird childhood.
Don't hear that one often.
No, but I really love it. I love it. I still do. And so in the 4 years I was in college, I thought, great, I'll go out and get my master's degree, then I'll go on and get my PhD, and then I'll teach. And this, I seem to be on the perfect track. So senior year, I applied and got into my top choice master's program to study with the guy that was a complete theological hero to me, because yes, theologians have heroes too. and I even got a full scholarship. But then 2 weeks before I was supposed to leave for grad school, I had a complete breakdown. And, now obviously I know it was an anxiety attack. It was, the chronic depression that I had dealt with for pretty much my whole life, just kind of rearing its ugly head again. But at the time, it just felt like this existential crisis of, I'm going to go into debt. I'm going to never be able to pay that debt back. I'm going to, have zero prospects of actually finding a job. I'm not going to make any money. I'm going to have zero job security. Just over and over and over again, this negative stuff. And so I pulled out and I quit before I even got there, before I even got started. And I took a full-time job at what had been my summer job, which was at a Borders Books and Music, if anyone remembers those.
Yeah, I remember Borders.
And so I started there as the cafe manager. So I learned how to manage a coffee shop, managing inventory, people, sales, merchandising, all of that stuff, in addition to learning how to brew really yummy coffee, which was great. And I worked my way up there over the course of about 5 years, to the point where I had been training and being prepared for taking over the store completely. At the end, I was one of three managers. I was in charge of sales, HR, merchandising, marketing, all of that kind of stuff. But I was supposed to step up into the last job of this $5 million store. And I interviewed for the position. I got through the interview. The interviewer, who was another general manager, said, "Oh, that was awesome. We'll be in touch. I can't wait to work with you. This is great." And then I went on maternity leave. I was 9 months pregnant when I had this interview. And a few days later, before I had given birth, I got a phone call from one of the other managers, and she said, "Tara, I'm so sorry. They gave the job to somebody else. She's not been with the company as long. She's not. She doesn't have as much experience as you, but that they gave her the job. And I'm so, so sorry that I have to be the one to tell you." And I was furious, absolutely furious. I felt I'd been discriminated against. I felt that that people had gone behind my back. I felt that, they had ignored all regular, chain of command in notifying me of this. But the next day, I calmed myself down and I sat down at my kitchen table and I decided, if other people can be freelancers, if other people can find clients for themselves to make money that, to support themselves from home with their children, if other people can work online, then certainly I can too. And so I sat down at my kitchen table and I wrote down all the things, all the skills that I had to offer an organization. Then I wrote down all the organizations that I knew I could help. And then I had to put it away because then I gave birth. but 6 months later, I had done tons of research into what it was to start a business, what it was to be a freelancer, what it was to offer your skills to other people directly outside of a job. And in January of 2009, then I started my first website. And it's nothing like what I'm doing today. but that experience of starting that website and then buying another one and then realizing what my real strengths were and what I really had to offer to people and what I was really interested in as well, had gradually led me to where I am today. So exactly what I've been doing today, I've been doing for about 5 years now. and okay. I've been in business for 7.
Okay, got you. So you mentioned being a freelancer. So did you actually freelance? And if so, what did you do?
So I would call it freelancing now, knowing what I know now. At the time, I thought that I was a business owner and I was doing business things. But really what I was doing was freelancing. I was offering, certain services at an hourly rate. And, I don't think necessarily the business ownership versus freelance, I don't think it's a matter of like quality. I think it's just like call a spade, right? And so I was definitely freelancing. What I really wanted to do was own a business, and I didn't know what that looked like yet. Okay. So I was doing my best.
Right. So about 5 years ago, you started to really get serious about this thing. And what you are doing now is that's when things started to take shape. Did I hear that right?
Yeah. I mean, I got really serious with it within the first year. I had started making more money than I had been making in my day job, which was not a lot of money. Borders did not pay well.
Yeah. No surprise.
Yeah. But it was still like, holy crap. I can't believe this is happening. I think it took another year after that to hit the 6-figure mark in terms of annual revenue. So I started making really good money doing slightly different things than I'm doing right now. But it was really at that two-year mark that I really made the decision to say, I love business and I want to figure this out and I want to figure it out for other people.
Why? Why did you make that pivot?
I found myself really constrained by what I had created to that point and what I had grown to that point. So early in my business, I actually bought another website from the woman who had started it. And it was a DIY craft lifestyle blog. It had a good bit of traffic, a good number of subscribers for the time. It was making good advertising revenue, again, back in the day. But that container for me, it started to feel really constraining. Like I couldn't talk about the things I really wanted to talk about. I couldn't explore the issues I really wanted to explore. And so I kept that site running for quite a while before I sold it to someone else. But I needed someplace else to go. I needed a personal brand, basically, to explore all of the things that I wanted to explore before I started to really focus in again and then create another company brand.
So when did you, so there's this transitioning happening and then you decide, I really want to talk about business. When did you then make the decision, okay, I want to teach about business?
I think it was basically at the same time. I'd already been doing it to a degree through that other site, but it wasn't... It needed its own home. It needed a different container. So it was basically the same decision. I was doing, a lot of one-to-one coaching at the time as well. But I knew that my best work was done in groups. It's always like, I love teaching. I've never thought I was very good at it, but I love it. I love speaking. I love teaching. I love performing. And so being able to pull together a group of people and offer them a piece of me, a piece of my knowledge, a piece of, wisdom is something that I've always wanted to do. So it's sort of been a part of the plan, such as it was, from the beginning.
So let's put a timeline on it. When did you begin or when did you create your first course or workshop? What was it?
I believe I created my first course in March of 2010.
Okay.
So I've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah, you have. And why did you decide, okay, I've been doing the one-on-ones, it's time for me to create a course?
It was mostly, I wouldn't say that there was a realization, I don't think there was sort of that realization in the transition from going to one-on-one to creating the course. It was more that I had identified a particular question that a lot of people had, and I had an answer to it. And so it seemed like the easiest way to answer that question was to create a course. So it wasn't about, I'm going to go off and make a lot of money with a course, or I'm going to free up a lot of my time with a course. It was, what is it that everyone is asking? What is it that they're saying they don't know? And, or, realizing there was this thing that they didn't know and offering a solution to that.
Yeah. So you've been making courses and learning products for a really long time, in the world of online entrepreneurship. And you started when not a lot of people were doing it. Now it seems everyone has a course. What have you seen as far as the changes from when you started to where we are now?
That's a great question. So many changes. Yes. First of all, format-wise, the formats today are completely different than they used to be. Even in 2010, video was accessible, but not ridiculously easy like it is today. Yeah. And so a lot of courses were simply written. They were sent out by drip email. They were done on private blogs, which is how I ran mine. And they were just super duper simple. And I still do a lot of things like that today. I love drip email courses. I love, kind of private blog or private site courses that are just written and just really easy for someone to access. But I also know that there's a lot of value in multiple formats, in the video format, in an audio format, which is also how I predominantly do programs now. And so that's changed. Price point has changed dramatically. Just people's willingness to go after a course right away, where it used to be that the Holy Grail was writing an ebook and then we'd sell these ebooks for like $100. Yeah. And nobody does that anymore. Or very few people do that anymore. And I love that trend too. I love that ebooks are so inexpensive now. I love that. And then the other thing that I have noticed with courses, and this one I'm not so keen on, is that I see a lot of people skipping customer awareness, customer experience, and going right to e-courses. And what I mean by that is that because e-courses are so prevalent now, people get into a business thinking, I'm just going to create an e-course and then I'll make a lot of money. And that's not how it works. It's not that you can't start with an e-course, but really what you need to start with is an audience. And one of the easiest ways to build building an audience generally takes time. And one of the easiest ways to make money while you're building an audience is to offer services to actually deal with people one-to-one. And I think people think that that's like a cop-out somehow, that this isn't what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be leveraging my time and making a course. But the problem with making a course and not having ever worked with someone or having, you know, vast amounts of corporate or professional or, you know, educational experience in an area. So you don't actually know what people want. You don't know what their roadblocks are. You don't know what their obstacles are. And so you spend all this time and money and energy on creating a course that nobody wants and that isn't useful to people and that isn't user-friendly. And so that's another thing that I've seen really change that I'm actively campaigning against.
I'm so glad you said that because I literally wrote about that maybe about a month ago.
Oh, great.
Because I noticed the same thing. And you know, I just can't help but be real. I think that, yes, part of it is people want to jump into making a course, but also it's about like doing the work and realizing that we have to do the work. You have to get to know your audience. So I'm curious, you know, kind of related to doing the work, what are your thoughts about, because I know that you work with Breanne Dick, mm-hmm. who also was on the show. What are your thoughts about the quality of online learning and the learning experience within online courses these days?
Oh, man. So I am not a huge consumer of online courses, but obviously I work with a lot of people in the process of creating online courses. I mean, and I have to say, I'm probably biased with my audience too, because, man, my audience is just a bunch of smarty pants people. and literally, like, we've done a lot of research in the last year on exactly who our people are. And, you know, there is a significantly higher proportion of master's and PhD and professional degree holders in our audience, not only versus other audiences, but based on the general public as well. And so we're talking about like a third of my audience has higher degrees. And so they don't do anything that's not super high quality. And in fact, that can really trip them up a lot because they have such high expectations for themselves. They've set the bar so high that anything they do seems like it's not good enough. I would say by and large, from what I'm exposed to, I'm actually really impressed with the quality of courses that are out there today. I think I probably run in some different circles than other people do. I know there's lots of really bad stuff out there too. So I'm not, I actually don't feel like I have a good vantage point for saying overall what I think the trend is quality-wise. But I also think going back to sort of how things have changed, I don't think format dictates the quality of something anymore. Right. So it had been in the beginning that people who were investing in video, for instance, were creating super high quality courses or programs. Now, because video is so accessible, it is not an indicator of quality whatsoever. And some of the best courses I've seen are still those simple written drip email courses. They can be so specific, so easy to access, so high quality. And a lot of times the video programs are just fluff. So I don't know that I answered your question at all.
But you did.
Okay, good.
You did. I mean, there's really no specific answer because ultimately, like a lot of things, it runs the gamut. Yeah. You know, you have your courses that aren't so good and you have your courses that are very great quality. And I think one of the things that you said for course creators is it's so, so important to know your audience. And we hear that all the time and we know that, but we don't often hear it the way you phrased it of when you're creating a course, know your audience's demographics, because that's also a big factor in what they're expecting from you.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I love that you said that. So we're going to come back to all this fun stuff about quality and learning, but I want to switch gears for a second and talk about Creative Live, because you have several classes and workshops that you've done on Creative Live. And for those who don't know, can you tell us what Creative Live is and why it's a great fit for you?
Yeah. So I love Creative Live. They are fantastic friends and partners to me. Creative Live is an online learning platform. It started primarily geared to photographers. They moved into videographers. They moved into art and design. And 2 years ago, they moved into business and lifestyle and a couple of other things as well. And so I teach on the Money and Life channel, which is all about what it says it is. And they do ridiculously high quality productions of courses from anything from, you know, how to use your DSLR camera to how to grow your audience of your blog to how to turn your service into your into a product, which was my last course with them. And they are fantastic because it was started by Chase Jarvis, who is a world-renowned photographer and videographer, and Craig Swanson, who is a super smart creative tech guy. Like, he just, the way he problem solves is constantly inspiring to me. And so the people who started this company are so invested in the quality of what they do. Like, quality is one of their highest values. And so when I go into Creative Live, or even like, let's say when I start working on a new course with them, I'm working right alongside a content producer who is walking me step by step through exactly what the Creative Live audience needs, and then balanced with what exactly my audience needs, how to make the most of their format, how to really like brainstorming engaging activities for keeping both the in-person and offline audience engaged, how to work the camera, how to work with the host, how to sell. It is just the content production there has taught me so much and is such, it should be a role model for not only other companies that are doing something similar like mine, but people who are, anyone who is, you know, wanting to think about how to develop a program.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. For anyone who doesn't know about Creative Live, because I've recently got a few questions about Creative Live, which is why I wanted to ask you, there is a bit of a primer for you to go check it out.
Yeah.
So let's come back to our conversation that we were having. And I've got a question for you that I like to ask. How do you define success within your online courses?
That's a great question. So personally, the not quite metric that I use is just sort of the responses that I get from individuals. Because our programs are so personalized in that we're guiding people through creating a strategy, which then ends up looking tactically like all sorts of different things. So there aren't a lot of hard and fast metrics that we can actually track. The one that we pay most attention to is revenue, because we want people to make more money. That's super important to us. But the main thing that I look for to make sure that I'm feeling that I think the program is a success and that I know my students think it's a success is when they email me or post in our communities or, you know, share publicly that they've had a breakthrough, that they've achieved something that they couldn't achieve, that they've changed their identity. That's a big one for us. And so that's actually a metric that, again, not quite metric, that I use a lot, which is I want people to change the relationship they have with their business in our programs. So often what that looks like to me is, you know, they come in having this relationship with their business where it is them, they are it. And one of the things that I want in all of our programs is for people to be able to detach themselves from their businesses and make more objective decisions, plans, goals, all of that, so that they can decide whether they want to stay a business of one or two or grow into something much, much, much bigger. And so over time, I've seen that more and more and more, and also more kind of as I've tracked it and as I've understood that as a goal that we have, That's one of the big things that defines success for me, is that when people leave our programs, not just with an action plan, not just with more money, but really having a different relationship with their business and a different understanding of their role within that business, that's a huge victory for me.
Do you track? So it's qualitative.
Definitely
qualitative. What methods, or do you have a way of capturing or tracking, you know, the success that people are having in as far as those results?
Yeah, you know, yes and no. It's not like I have a spreadsheet that says this number of people change their identity or change their relationship with their business. Although I'm sure Brianne would like us to have that. instead, we have a lot of different things. So we have communities where people are posting and sharing their progress, and you know, we have coaches that they're working with, and they report back progress to me. And then we also do a feedback survey at the end of every cohort as well, and so we get that response there. And then finally, we also collect case studies from people. And so that's something that I look for in those case studies as well. So we've got a lot of different ways that people can give us that information, but we don't have a nice, clean spreadsheet that shows all of those successes.
Yeah, which is totally fine. I mean, I really asked that question because, you know, I come from a background of corporate e-learning and online courses for colleges and universities, and there's analytics and measurement is huge. Mm-hmm. And I see as courses, online entrepreneurs create courses, we're getting to this point where the quality is improving, which is a great thing. And learning how, or figuring out how to measure, how to capture metrics, I think is part of the next phase of online courses, which is why I was just curious to see, because I know Brianne is very much a stickler for stuff like
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's definitely part of my goals, probably not for this next session that we have, because we're working on completely revamping the content of our flagship program. But this fall, when we release it again, I would love to incorporate, and I had tried to do it a couple of years ago and we had software issues, but I'd love to incorporate a system of surveys, you know, at the beginning, middle, and end, that allow people to say, this is my level of comfort with this, or this is the score I give myself in this area on a scale from 1 to 10, so that we can see people's comfort level rise, their skill level rise, their understanding level rise as they go through the program. Because, you know, just from a sales and marketing perspective, on top of a, you know, learning success perspective, I'd like to be able to say 90% of our participants see a 50% rise in comfortability with, marketing or brand strategy or whatever it might be. I'd love to be able to talk about those kind of metrics.
Absolutely. It's all about results. And what's the quote? What gets measured gets managed.
Exactly.
So. Great. So we've done a lot of talking, but we have yet to talk about Quiet Power Strategy. Yeah. So this is your flagship program. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So actually, we're making a little bit of a transition this year where Quiet Power Strategy is now our brand. It's sort of the philosophy behind everything that we do. And then we've got a number of other programs that fall under it. The flagship one is now going to be called Quiet Power Strategy, the Foundation. And it's all about creating a focused action plan based on, you know, those foundational elements of any thriving business: an understanding of your brand, an understanding of your revenue model, a product suite that really works for you, and marketing and sales systems that bring in the money, right? And so those are sort of the pillars of that newly revamped program that I'm just ridiculously excited about. And then we have a number of other things as well. We offer Brianne's the Masterclass program, which is about creating a flagship program yourself, and with all her smarts when it comes to curriculum strategy and learning, understanding, and all of that kind of stuff. Then we offer another one called Connect to Sell, which is a passive selling program. So, you know, how do you make your content marketing actually sell for you? So we're running that for the first time right now. We're going to be offering a program on, you know, growing your audience and your influence with Bridget Lyons. We've got another sales program coming down the line, and we'll have a website strategy program coming down the line as well.
Okay. And who's the ideal learner for your program? I mean, there's courses, individual courses within the flagship and the brand.
Yes.
So it's a little... Can you speak to that?
Yeah. I'll let you. So our goal is to be the go-to business training source for idea-driven entrepreneurs. And what I mean by idea-driven entrepreneurs are people who have a message, a methodology, an idea that they want to put out into the world in a really big way. They might have been offering one-to-one services in the past. They might have been an academic in the past. As I mentioned earlier, we work with a lot of academics, you know, people who see opportunities to share what they've been doing in a much bigger way, a la Brené Brown, for example. And we work with a lot of people who have immense amounts of corporate experience and want to channel that into a business as well. So not so much people that are escaping the 9-to-5 or the escaping the cubicle, but people who are saying, I've got all this experience. I see this huge opportunity out there. I'm going to go capitalize on that. So those are our people. And they have some very particular roadblocks, which is what we really specialize in. They've got the curse of the expert, right? They have a horrible time seeing things from their customer's perspective, which is probably one of my best strengths. So we talk a lot about that. They're really afraid when it comes to marketing and sales. And so we spend a lot of time on that. And then they also just don't understand how to package or reframe their ideas in ways that people really want to buy. And so in all of our programs, kind of product development or product refinement is a huge piece of the puzzle.
So I've got two questions for you before we get into the wrap-up portion.
Sure.
The first one I absolutely have to ask, because your knowledge of your audience is just immense. What are some things that you do? What are some strategies or tactics, rather, that you employ to know your audience this deeply?
Oh, yeah. Well, how long do you have? I mean, I can talk for days about this.
Okay, give me three.
So one of our mantras is personalization, not generalization. What I mean by that is we don't talk in terms of ideal clients. We talk in terms of real people. So when I talk about my audience, I am referencing maybe 5 people that for me represent everyone that I want to work with. And I am constantly amazed, even though I have confidence in this, I'm constantly amazed that when we open enrollment, I just get those people over, like carbon copies of those people in the best way possible over and over and over again. And enrollment time for me is just so exciting because it's like, oh, wow, these are 40 of my new best friends. I'm so excited. And so that's one thing that we start with is we don't do ideal client profiles. I don't teach ideal client profiles. I don't think it works. We focus on individual people and forget everything else because that's what's most important to us. The second piece of that is we also focus on their journey. So instead of thinking about who this person is right at this very moment, which is what an ideal client profile asks you to do, we think of them over time. When did they first get interested in whatever it is that we do? When did they first start engaging in this conversation, asking these questions, doing these Google searches? What was going on in their life? What problems did they have? What goals did they have? And we start with that. And then we look at what their ultimate goal is. What do they really want to achieve? And maybe their ultimate goal, they don't even know about yet, because maybe it's something that only we know about, but we know that it's out there. And then we look at the whole span of time between those two things. And it can be a long time. I mean, we could be talking about a 20 or 30 year period or more. And we look at what are the roadblocks these people are going to run into? How is their goal going to evolve over time? What are the new questions they're going to ask later on as they evolve and as they learn new things? And that gives us not just that hyper-personalized look at who our customer is, but it also gives us a way to create for them in the long term, because we know that a loyal client is a way cheaper client to sell to. And so we know that if we can, as I said, become that go-to source, if we can answer every question they have through a product or a program or a piece of marketing, they're going to be with us for the long haul. And so there's that as well. And then let me give you one more good one.
Bonus.
Oh, yeah. So I think the last one is just understanding that social media understanding that social media's biggest strength isn't as a broadcasting tool, it's as a listening tool. And yes. So I spend a lot of time on social media, and I'm sure some people would think that I post a lot too, although I don't post nearly as much as I used to. What I'm really doing most often when I'm on social media is listening. I'm looking at what people are posting, and I'm trying to figure out what's really going on. What's the question they're really asking? What's the fear that they really have? What's the goal that they really have? And so by doing that, I can do vast amount of research super duper fast. And I can engage people, one-to-one or as a group, to see if I'm right about what I think is going on.
Okay. So it's okay if you're a lurker.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No. I specialize in listeners and observers because that is what I am. And yes. Yeah, I love doing interviews and I love getting on stage and I love teaching and I love talking at people. But, you know, the vast majority of my life is lived as a listener and as an observer. I am a hardcore introvert, and there is nothing that pleases me more than being able to just watch people do their thing and figure out what's really going on.
Absolutely. Okay. So because you have this excellent flagship program, I have to ask, for anyone wondering, what or how is creating a flagship program different? Was your approach different as compared to creating a one-off course?
Ooh, that's a really good question. No one has ever asked me that before. So kudos to you on that. I would say my approach in creating, like actually creating it, was no different than what I still do to this very day, which is sort of mind mapping out everything that I think that I want to give someone and then editing that down into what they actually need. Like that's the basis of my process for everything. But in thinking about what I wanted this program to represent, it's very much akin to creating a brand strategy. So yeah, there's the program element and there's the curriculum and there's the how I'm going to sell it and why people need it and why people need it right now and all of that stuff. But there's also what the program represents. And to me, that's the brand. And I, from day one, I wanted this program to represent something that was not currently available online, especially to the group of people that I wanted to sell to, which was a next level program that facilitated connections between other smart, savvy entrepreneurs. So not only do we teach, but not only do we teach and kind of guide and consult, but we also facilitate people connecting to each other. And so those ideas have grown to kind of represent what our brand is in total. And I think, you know, that's part of it just happened when I got lucky. And part of it was absolutely very strategic. It was, this is what I want to represent me. This is what I want to represent, you know, the last 5 years of work. This is what I want people to think of when they think of my brand.
Mm. This has been so great. Tara, we're down to the final three questions.
All right.
So the first one, what's next for you? Anything exciting coming up?
Oh, yeah. We are hosting our very first conference in Portland on April 30th and May 1st. It's called Quiet Power Strategy, the Summit. And that's sort of like the big, scary new thing on the horizon that I am ridiculously excited about.
Very cool. So where can people find out more about you?
Yeah. So the best place to go to find out more about Quiet Power Strategy is quietpowerstrategy.com. There's all sorts of resources that you can download there for free. If you want to kind of read the last 7 years of blog posts that I've written on business strategy and knowing your customer and all of that stuff is still mostly housed at taragentile.com. And then if you want to talk to me, the best place to talk to me is always Twitter. I love getting tweets. And so that's easy. That's just at Tara Gentile.
Okay. Last question. What's your why? Why do you get up and do this work every day?
Because I am driven to figure things out. And I want to figure things out for people who don't have that drive to figure it out, but who have great work to do in the world. And if I wasn't figuring this out, I would be figuring something else out. I just really love to get to the bottom of any idea or any process. That's my why. That's why I do it.
Tara, thank you so much. This has been an amazing interview.
Thank you.
Welcome to the outro. So before we wrap up, I want to give a huge thank you to Tara for sharing her experience and expertise with us. I hope you enjoyed what she had to say. Lots of gems in that particular episode. Welcome to the outro. So before we wrap up, I just want to give a huge thank you to Tara for sharing her experience and expertise with us. Lots of gems in what she had to say. I hope you enjoyed it. Now, if you want to check out the show notes for this episode and find all of the links that Tara mentioned, just head to zencourses.co/026. That's zencourses.co/026 for episode 26. Just remember it's .co, not .com. Okay, so my top three takeaways from this episode were, number one, services are a great way to learn about your audience's needs before you create a course. I know that people say that you can go ahead and create a course before you begin interacting with your customers, but Tara and I both agree that if you really want to learn about your audience and learn about their needs and get the questions that they have, offering services, whether it's one-on-one consulting or something else, is a great way to do that. So definitely don't take it from me, take it from Tara. Services are a great way to start. The second takeaway was, don't guess about who your audience is. Don't try to create ideal profiles that are based on a lot of guessing. Talk to your people. Talk to the people who are on your mailing list. Find out, you know, what's going on with them. What are they struggling with? What do they want to do? How do they think you can help? Where do they live? What are some challenges that they're having right now? What are they good at? What do they know? All of these things help you get a clearer picture of who your audience is so that you can create solutions and products to help them. And then the third takeaway is one that Tara and I both kind of felt a little strongly about, and that is that high-end video production doesn't necessarily make a great course. And what we both meant by that is that there are a lot of courses out there that are amazing. And then there's courses out there that people invest, the course creators invest in really high-end video production. But when you get in the course, it's kind of underwhelming as far as the actual content. And just to be quite honest, the success of the learners. So definitely, definitely take that to heart. If you're buying a course, just make sure, if it looks really flashy, make sure that, hey, the content is there. And also, if you're creating a course, don't just try to make something that looks flashy and doesn't really do what you promise. So those are my top three. There were plenty of more. I hope that you got some of your own too. Drop me a line and let me know what they were. You can always email me at hello@zencourses.co. That's hello@zencourses.co. Now, before we get out of here, I need to ask a favor. I have set a goal to get 50 iTunes reviews for the Zen Courses show. Would you do me a big favor and take 3 minutes, just 3 minutes out of your day to write one? Just head over to the podcast section in the iTunes store and search for the Zen Courses show and click write a review. Your review will help more people who need help making an online course to discover the show and get the help that they need. So will you do that for me? I would really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And lastly, if you want to stay up to date with the Zen Courses blog to get new articles, to find out updates on new and exciting products that I have coming up starting in April. And let's be frank, let's be friends. Join the mailing list. You can sign up over at zencourses.co/newsletter. Just head to the homepage, and if you can't remember that URL, just head to the homepage and you can sign up there. Once again, that's zencourses.co/newsletter. All right, it is that time. As always, thank you for hanging out with me. I am Janelle Allen, and this has been the Zen Courses Show. Have a great day.